Well, good morning. So good to be here with you all this morning. And summer is here, not only because the heat index is supposed to be 106 today, but because school is out and people are traveling. So we're mindful of those of our brothers and sisters who are traveling today. But we are equally enthusiastic about those visitors who are traveled here to be with us. I want you to know that you are honored guests, and we're very happy to have you with us and hope that you'll come back and worship with us anytime you may be traveling through or have the opportunity in the future. One of those who is traveling this morning is obviously Don, and he's at FC Camp in Louisiana at Dry Creek, so be mindful of him and the camp efforts this week there. If you'd like to turn your Bibles this morning, we'll be primarily in the book of 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel. And as you're searching back towards the beginning of your Bible to find the book of 1 Samuel, when we think about characters in the Old Testament that have a lot of narratives, a lot of stories that we can tell about them, there are a few that come to mind. Obviously, Moses had quite a life and a lot to be learned and a lot to be said about that. Several of the prophets had quite interesting lives we tell many stories from. But I would argue, at least in a children's Bible class, or maybe no character in the Old Testament who we tell more stories about than that of King David. When you think about David's entire life, think about his selection. Think about when he was chosen from Jesse, and he wasn't even present, right? No one even thought about him. He's still in the field as the youngest of Jesse's sons. Think about his underdog victory, if you will, against Goliath, right, of the Philistines. Obviously, maybe the biggest underdog upset ever recorded for us. We still refer to it, a David versus Goliath matchup. A lot of people root for David. Very few people root for Goliath. But obviously a very impactful story from the life of David. We think about his sin in particular with Bathsheba and all of the stories that we draw from that. How could he, as king of Israel, have everything and yet lust after a woman who was not his wife and was actually the wife of another man and commit that sin? And then we think about what happened, you know, with the lineage of David, right? His son, Solomon, who would ultimately take over the throne, came from Bathsheba. But his other sons rebelled against him. And you know, there's a lot to be said about the strife that he had with those. But ultimately, we know his lineage resulted in the birth of Jesus Christ several centuries later. So there's a lot to be taken from the life of David and many sermons we can preach. But today I want to focus on an interesting relationship in the life of David. One of the most intriguing and unique stories, maybe recorded for us anywhere in the Bible, has to do with David and his friend Jonathan. The relationship between David and Jonathan is one that may be the greatest mortal friendship that's ever been recorded for us. And so this morning I'd like for us to read together through several passages in the book of 1 Samuel to orient us to who is Jonathan, who is David at the time, how this friendship came about, and what made this friendship so special. And then we'll draw some lessons for our sake today. But let's begin our story in the book of 1 Samuel chapter 13. And this is the first time that we meet Samuel. At the beginning of chapter 13, we see that Saul chose for himself several thousand men from Israel to fight against the Philistines, and some were in his charge, and some were in the charge of Jonathan. We'll skip to verse 8 to begin reading this morning, but beginning in verse 8, it says, "Then he waited 7 days." This is after they've won the battle against the Philistines. Speaking of Saul, "he waited 7 days according to the time set by Samuel, the prophet. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. So Saul said, 'Bring a burnt offering and peace offerings here to me.' And he offered the burnt offering. Now it happened as soon as he had finished presenting the burnt offering that Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him that he might greet him. And Samuel said, 'What have you done?' Saul said, 'When I saw that the people were scattered from me and that you did not come within the days appointed and that the Philistines gathered together at Michmash, then I said, the Philistines will now come down on me at Gilgal, and I have not made supplication to the Lord. Therefore, I felt compelled and offered a burnt offering.' And Samuel said to Saul, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever, but now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be the commander over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded. Then Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin, and Saul numbered the people present with him, about 600 men. Saul, Jonathan his son, and the people present with them remained in Gibeah of Benjamin, but the Philistines encamped at Michmash. This is the first time we actually are told exactly who Jonathan is. And in chapter 13, verse 1, it's Saul and some other leader of his men, right, named Jonathan. But it's not here until verse 16 that Jonathan is identified as the son of Saul. What's really interesting about this is what directly preceded it. What did we begin by reading? We began by reading the sin of Saul, Jonathan's father, that ultimately led to the selection of David from outside of Saul's family to be his heir, to supplant him as king one day. And then we were immediately greeted with, by the way, Jonathan is Saul's son. So interesting to me that Jonathan, who is arguably the biggest loser, if you will, in the sin of Saul, other than perhaps Saul himself, is here, right? That's how we get to know him. In chapter 14, we read on, and Jonathan is painted as a great war hero, right? He continues to lead men against the Philistines, continues to see success, continues to win many victories. And yet, there's an interesting story in chapter 14, which I don't believe we have time to read the full length of, but in chapter 14, we see for the first time Jonathan's attempted killing at the hands of his father. Saul, in chapter 14, while they're at war with the Philistines, makes this ill-fated oath that says, none of my men will taste any food until we win the battle. And Jonathan, not knowing what his father had said, dipped his staff in honey and tasted some honey. And it appears from the text that Jonathan didn't fully agree. When the men told him what his father had said, he didn't fully agree with his father's decision. But his father stood ready to stand by what he had said and put his own son to death. Ultimately, that's averted. But the story of Jonathan and David together almost ends without ever beginning in chapter 14. In chapter 15, specifically in verse 35, we see that as Saul continues to not do the will of the Lord, in chapter 15, verse 35, we're told that God began to regret, the Lord began to regret having made Saul king over Israel. In chapter 16, kind of as a separate line, we see David's anointing to be the next king of Israel. Critically, it's not to be immediately king of Israel, but his anointment to be the next king of Israel to come. And then in chapter 17, we get back to the really good Bible class section of the story of David. David versus Goliath, recorded for us in chapter 17. I'd like for us to pick up the story in verse 48. There's a lot to be said about the encounter between David and Goliath, but let's pick up our reading in verse 48. It says, so it was when the Philistine, that is Goliath, arose and came and drew near to meet David, that David hurried and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. Then David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone, and he slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead, so that the stone sank into his forehead, and he fell on his face to the earth. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood over the Philistine, took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. Now the men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the entrance of the valley and to the gates of Ekron. And the wounded of the Philistines fell along the road to Sherem, even as far as Gath and Ekron. Then the children of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their tents. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. When Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, Abner, whose son is this youth? And Abner said, as your soul lives, O king, I do not know. So the king said, inquire whose son this young man is. Then, as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, whose son are you, young man? So David answered, "I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." Now when he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Saul took him that day and would not let him go home to his father's house anymore. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan took off the robe that was on him and gave it to David with his armor, even to his sword and his bow and his belt. So David went out wherever Saul sent him and behaved wisely. And Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servant. The friendship is immediate, and the friendship is strong. And it's not really painted for us explicitly what the catalyst for this friendship is, right? We can speculate. We can say that like recognizes like. You're both great men of war. I respect, you know, what you've done. I myself have killed thousands of Philistines. You have slaughtered the greatest of the Philistines. We have something in common, right? Perhaps that was where the friendship was born out of. But it seems to be something even deeper than that. One thing that we are not told is we are not told if Jonathan realizes what the path is that God has set David on. We're not sure at this point if Jonathan knows that David is set to be the next king of Israel, and I would argue that Jonathan doesn't. It's not recorded for us, but I would argue that he doesn't know that. But from us as the reader, who knows who Jonathan is as the son of Saul and knows who David is as the heir apparent to the throne, it's a really unlikely friendship on paper, right? The person who's taken my birthright is now going to be my best friend. And it's, as I said, a really tight bond. We see that it says in verse 3 that they made a covenant. They loved as their own soul. They're obviously, as it said in verse 1, they're knit together. Their souls are knit together. And so I think the best modern translation is, this is my best friend, right? This is my best friend. And that's what we see between Jonathan and David. And what's interesting is, as we fast forward, this is a friendship that remains in place for the rest of their lives, right? How long those lives will be, we haven't gotten to yet, but this is a friendship that remains in place for the rest of their lives. In chapter 19, if we flip ahead, chapter 19, beginning in verse 1, we'll pick up the story. It says, "Now Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants, that they should kill David." So something's changed. This great champion who's just slaughtered the champion of the Philistines is now enemy number one of the king. "Jonathan, my son, all my servants, hear me out. We're going to kill David." But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted greatly in David. So Jonathan told David, saying, "My father Saul seeks to kill you. Therefore, please be on your guard until morning, and stay in a secret place and hide, and I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak with my father about you. Then what I observe, I will tell you." Thus Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, "Let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his works have been very good toward you. For he took his life in his hands and killed the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood to kill David without a cause?" So Saul heeded the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be killed." Then Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him all these things. So Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as in times past. We saw at the end of the slaying of Goliath that Saul didn't allow him to go back to Jesse's house, right? Saul kept him alongside himself. And in the interim, in between our sections, David was set over, you know, many of Saul's legions. David actually marries a daughter of Saul, so Jonathan becomes his brother-in-law. But obviously there's some strife. Do you think that Jonathan took on some risk in standing up to his father? I think Jonathan took on a great deal of risk in standing up to his father. Remember, Saul has already threatened to kill Jonathan himself once at this point. He's now angry against David, and you could quickly see where this could go the other way. It could say, "Hey, I'm a friend of David. I'm going to stand up for him." And Saul's like, "Oh, you're with him. I'll kill both of you. No problem." But luckily for our story, Saul heeds the words of his son and brings David kind of back into the fold, if you will. However, this is short-lived. Perhaps the most famous picture, thinking back to Bible class and what I was attempting to remember when I was, I don't know, 6, 7, 8, is what is the first story of David and Jonathan that I heard? It's the story in chapter 20. It's the story of the message and the way it's going to be delivered, with the servant firing an arrow to be a symbol of what the message from King Saul actually is. We'll pick up the story in 1 Samuel chapter 20. Let's begin in verse 27 of that chapter. It says, "And it happened the next day, the second day of the month, that David's place was empty." This is his place at the king's table. "And Saul said to Jonathan, his son, 'Why has the son of Jesse not come to eat, either yesterday or today? He's been absent for 2 days now.' So Jonathan answered Saul, 'David earnestly asked permission of me to go to Bethlehem. And he said, please let me go, for our family has a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. And now, if I have found favor in your eyes, please let me get away and see my brothers. Therefore, he has not come to the king's table.' Then Saul's anger was aroused against Jonathan, and he said to him, 'You son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, you shall not be established, nor your kingdom. Now, therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die.'" So what is Saul saying? Why are you his friend? As long as he is alive, he's been chosen by God. If we get rid of him, you should logically be back in line to be king, right? How can you align yourself with the man who's taking your birthright? But remember, they're best friends. Their souls are knit together. Picking it up in verse 32, "And Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said to him, 'Why should he be killed? What has he done?' Then Saul cast a spear at Jonathan to kill him, by which Jonathan knew that it was determined by his father to kill David. So Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had treated him shamefully." I actually think that it kind of mellows out there in verse 34. His father had treated him shamefully. His father had just thrown a spear across the table at him in an attempt to kill him. I would use a stronger adjective than shamefully, right? His father had moved in anger and made it very clear. You are in the camp with David. I'm going to kill David. And if you don't get up from this table, I'm going to kill you right here, right now. "And so it was in the morning that Jonathan went out into the field at the time appointed with David." This is the scenario they had already made together earlier in the chapter. "Then he said to his lad, 'Now run, find the arrows which I shoot.' As the lad ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. When the lad had come to the place where the arrow was, which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan cried out after the lad and said, 'Is not the arrow beyond you?' And Jonathan cried out after the lad, 'Make haste, hurry, do not delay.' So Jonathan's lad gathered up the arrows and came back to his master, but the lad did not know anything. Only Jonathan and David knew of the matter. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to his lad and said to him, 'Go carry them to the city.' As soon as the lad had gone, David arose from a place toward the south, fell on his face to the ground, and bowed down 3 times. And they kissed one another, and they wept together, but David more so. Then Jonathan said to David, 'Go in peace, since we have both sworn in the name of the Lord, saying, May the Lord be between you and me, and between your descendants and my descendants forever.' So he arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city." Jonathan and David, at least as recorded for us, will only meet one more time. David is about to go on the run for his life for at least several years. We can debate how many years, but for several years, David is going to go on the run from Saul for his life. And Jonathan, it appears, is going to remain at his father's side. I say that because we'll see what the future holds for Jonathan in subsequent chapters. But Jonathan and David will meet up at least one more time in chapter 23, while David is on the run. Ultimately, outside of that one encounter, this is probably the longest time that they spent with each other. And you can see the emotion between both sides of the equation, right? They both are weeping, records for us, David even more so. Have you ever lost a really close friend? Maybe they passed away. Maybe something came between you. The friendship has dissolved for some reason. They've never been hurt by the loss of a friend. That's what these two are going through. I've lost my best friend. And they didn't have Twitter to DM each other from wherever they were. For those who are my age and older, they didn't have text messaging to text message one another. They didn't have Snapchat, send a picture of, hey, I'm in this cave. They didn't have those options, right? This is literally the last time they're going to see each other, speak to each other, outside of One Chance Encounter, chapter 23. Ultimately, in chapter 31, Saul dies, right? Which is part of what is required for David to take his place on the throne. But in the death of Saul, we see that Jonathan falls alongside him, right? Jonathan is there. And so that is the dissolving, if you will, of Saul's line. And David goes on to inherit the throne as had been promised to him. So we read through a long narrative, a deep friendship, fairly quickly. And the question that you may logically have is, what should we take from the story? I think there are several things that we can take from the story of Jonathan and David's friendship. And particularly, I want to put us in the shoes of Jonathan, because I think that's the even more challenging position to be in, right? Again, go back to whether he knew it at the start, he at least knew it later on, that David is going to take what, by birth, would have logically been his. They should be, on so many other levels and in so many other times in human history, would have been the perfect plot for two people to be at war for the rest of their lives until one died. But they weren't. They were best friends until one of them died. What's interesting in the last recording there, as they are weeping, and they make that covenant, that God be between them and between their descendants forever, that's actually borne out. And I think that's the first point for us to take from this story, which is that a really great friendship can actually change lives. I submit to you that Jonathan and David's friendship changed both of their lives, rather dramatically in some instances. But obviously, you know, God had a divine will, and he would have made a way for it to happen. But Jonathan, on multiple occasions, assisted in David's escape from Saul's wrath, right? Whether it was speaking and counseling with his father to not be as, you know, upset and move to as much anger, or whether it was actively telling David, hey, you need to leave, you need to go, Saul is coming for you. That is a change in your life, right? To put someone else's well-being so blatantly at the forefront of your mind, and to actually put your life, as we said, at risk in doing so. I'd like us to come forward to the book of 2 Samuel in chapter 9 and read an account in 2 Samuel chapter 9. You may be familiar with the story, you may not be, but let's read 2 Samuel chapter 9 together. David is now king, and it says, "Now David said, 'Is there still anyone who is left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?'" So he's remembering his friend and saying, is there any distant relative out there? "And there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba. So when they had called him to David, the king said to him, 'Are you Ziba?' He said, 'At your service.' Then the king said, 'Is there not still someone of the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God?' And Ziba said to the king, 'There is still a son of Jonathan who is lame in both feet.' So the king said to him, 'Where is he?' And Ziba said to the king, 'Indeed, he is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, in Lo-debar.' Then King David sent and brought him out of the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, from Lo-debar. Now, when Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, had come to David, he fell on his face, and he prostrated himself. Then David said, 'Mephibosheth,' and he answered, 'Here is your servant.' So David said to him, 'Do not fear. I will surely show you kindness for Jonathan, your father's sake, and I will restore to you all the land of Saul, your grandfather, and you shall eat bread at my table continually.' Then he bowed himself and said, what is your servant that I should look upon such a dead dog as I? And the king called to Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, I have given to your master's son all that belonged to Saul and to all his house. You, therefore, and your sons and your servants shall work the land for him, and you shall bring in the harvest that your master's son may have food to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's son, shall eat bread at my table always. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, according to all that my lord the king has commanded his servant, so will your servant do. As for Mephibosheth, said the king, he shall eat at my table like one of the king's sons. Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah, and all who dwelt in the house of Ziba were servants of Mephibosheth. So Mephibosheth dwelt in Jerusalem, for he ate continually at the king's table, and he was lame in both of his feet. This is a really heartwarming story of compassion, right? I don't know if David had ever met Mephibosheth. It would seem to be he hadn't. If he did, he certainly obviously did not know his whereabouts or what his state of life was. And we're not really told anything about how Mephibosheth came to be lame in both feet. But think about the position he's in. He's essentially grandson of the former king, male heir, directly in line. If everything had gone smoothly, he may be in line to be king now. He would probably, you know, have all the duties of a prince, all the wealth of a prince, all those things. It appears he's living in someone else's house and he's lame in both feet. So it's difficult for him to make a living himself. And David has not just great compassion over him, but gives him a place at his table, right? Gives him a place as if he's one of his sons, almost as if he's an adopted son. You can't help but think that this is David looking back on that last covenant made with Jonathan in the field in chapter 20, right? And so as much as their friendship changed their own lives, their friendship ultimately changed lives for generations after them, right? With the adoption of Mephibosheth and the appointment of him to this land and these servants to work the land for him and all those things. So that's the first thing I think for all of us to keep in mind is that a truly great friendship has the true power to change lives. Another point that we've alluded to, but to harp on it a bit more, is that in a true great friendship, we can be propelled to put others before ourselves. We talk about this, right, as Christians, to love one another as yourself and, you know, to treat others the way you'd want to be treated. But Jonathan may have demonstrated as well as, again, any mortal friend in the Bible recorded for us what this means, the reality of this command, right? In Proverbs 17:17, it says, a friend loves at all times and a brother is born for adversity. It's a great proverb about friendship, right? It's a great proverb that sounds like David and Jonathan, born for this adversity that would be cast upon both of them. Think about the words of Jesus in John chapter 15, beginning in verse 12. It says, this is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. Again, just as Jesus laid down his life for us, Jonathan put his life on the line for David. And that's truly putting someone before yourselves. Jesus also in Matthew chapter 22, beginning in verse 36, spoken to by the Pharisees, teacher, which is the greatest command in the law? And he said to them, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment, and a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments have been all the law and the prophets. What does it really mean to love your neighbor as yourself, right? It really means that just as much as I would like to protect my own safety, my own physical welfare, if I love you just as much as I love myself, I want to protect your physical welfare, right? Even endangering my own, I want to protect your own physical welfare. And I think that's the second point for us. A truly great friendship will propel us to put others before ourselves. The last point I'd like for us to take away this morning is that a great friendship, a truly great friendship should build our relationship not only with one another, but our relationship with God. We see this in the covenant that David and Jonathan make, right? That God be between them, right? This is not dissimilar to the way we think about marriage. And oftentimes we have a ceremony in a wedding where we acknowledge the fact that there is a man, there is a woman, and there is God in this union, right? It's the same kind of relationship we see in the covenant that David and Jonathan take together. In 1 Samuel chapter 23, this is the recording of the last time David and Jonathan meet one another. Beginning in verse 15, it says, David saw that Saul had come out to seek his life. David was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh, and Jonathan, Saul's son, rose and went to David at Horesh and strengthened his hand in God. That verse, strengthened his hand in God, the Holman Christian Standard Bible says, encouraged him in his faith in God. The NIV says, helped him find strength in God. Strengthened his hand in God. And he said to him, do not fear, for the hand of Saul, my father, shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. Saul, my father, also knows this. And the two of them made a covenant before the Lord. David remained at Horesh, and Jonathan went home. Last time they see each other, at least recorded for us, last time they see each other. Again, they renew the covenant, but what did they do when they're together? Jonathan, again, think about it from his perspective, he strengthens David's faith in the Lord. You're in the middle of this extremely trying time. That's putting it lightly. You're on the run, again, for years, for your life, from the king. Don't worry, God is with you. We'll spend time together. Let's strengthen our faith in God together. That's what a truly great friendship looks like. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, beginning in verse 9, it says, for God did not appoint us to wrath, but to obtain salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, so that whether we are awake or asleep, we will live together with him. Therefore, encourage one another and build each other up as you are already doing. Right? That's the command given to us as first century Christians, right? As New Testament Christians, we should be building one another up. We should be strengthening one another's hand, encouraging our faith in God between ourselves. Many would say, can't argue, that the best friend you could ever want or could ever have is Jesus, right? I love the words of the song we sometimes sing, the Lily of the Valley. Lily of the Valley opens with, I have found a friend in Jesus. He's everything to me. Very simple. The lyrics go on, and there's a lot about being a friend with Jesus, right? Having Jesus on your side. But I love that opening line. The question you may have this morning is, what does it take to become a friend of Jesus? Well, we read it in John chapter 15, verse 14. Jesus said, you are my friends if you do what I command you. Very simple. You can be a friend of Jesus if you do what he commands of you. In 1 John chapter 5, the first five verses say, everyone who believes that Jesus is the Christ and has been born of God, and everyone who loves the Father loves whoever has been born of him. By this we know that we love the children of God when we love God and obey his commandments. For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. And his commandments are not burdensome. For everyone who has been born of God overcomes the world. And this is the victory that has overcome the world, our faith. Who is it that overcomes the world except the one who believes that Jesus is the Son of God? Do you believe this morning that Jesus is the Son of God? That he came and lived a sinless life and died on the cross for our sins to facilitate a relationship between ourselves as the ultimate sacrifice, that propitiation for our sins, we may have a relationship with the Father? If you believe that and you need to take on baptism this morning, the waters are prepared and ready for you. If you've already taken on baptism and you need prayers and encouragement, you need to renew your friendship with Jesus, we're here to help, whatever you may need.